So let's start again with a short meditation. So finding a nice comfortable posture. And allow your awareness to descend into the body, becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. And using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension. Allowing the body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. And allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. With each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen. Without dwelling in the past, without anticipating the future, simply allow the mind to rest in the present moment. Through focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Tonglen is Tibetan for giving and taking. It's a very powerful method to transform self-cherishing into the mind of cherishing others. A very powerful method for transforming attachment and aversion into loving kindness and compassion. No matter how much mental afflictions are in our mind, these are simply like dirt covering the surface of our mind. And underneath this dirt is the natural purity of the mind. This natural purity of mind is sometimes called Buddha nature, our potential to reach the highest goals imaginable. So we can imagine this deepest dimension of our mind, this inner purity. We can imagine this in the form of a small, white, radiant ball of light at the center of our chest, at the level of our heart. And first bring to mind someone close to you, a loved one, a friend, who's currently experiencing some sort of physical or mental problem or suffering. And picture them very clearly in front of you. And then arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if they were free of that problem, free of that suffering. May you be free of all suffering and its causes. And then imagine their problem or suffering in the form of black smoke filling their body. Then with each in-breath, imagine drawing that black smoke out of their body and bringing it into the sphere of light at your heart, completely dissolving it there. So with each in-breath, breathe in with compassion, dissolving and extinguishing their suffering at your heart, dissolving it into your inner wisdom. Now imagine that the black cloud has completely been extinguished. And now they're completely free of that problem or suffering. And take delight in this. And then arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if they had happiness and its causes. May you be truly well and happy. And then with each out-breath, imagine immeasurable rays of light radiating out from the sphere of light at your heart, completely saturating their body and mind, and transforming into everything they need to be happy. So with each out-breath, breathe out the light of loving kindness, sending them whatever they need to be happy. And now imagine that they've found the true happiness that they seek, and take delight in this. And now allow your field of loving kindness and compassion to expand out further. And allow your mind to move around. And whoever comes to mind, whether it's a loved one, a stranger, or even someone who you find a little bit difficult, bring them to mind. Attend to them. And again, imagine them very clearly in front of you. They are just like yourself in wanting to be happy and wanting to be free of suffering. And again, arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if they were free of suffering. May you be free of all suffering and its causes. And then imagine their past, present, and future suffering in the form of black smoke filling their body. And with each in-breath, imagine drawing that black smoke out of their body and bringing it into the sphere of light at your heart, completely dissolving it there. So with each in-breath, breathe in with compassion, dissolving and extinguishing their suffering at your heart. And then imagine the black cloud is being completely extinguished. And now they're completely free of all suffering and its causes. And take joy in this. And then arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if they had happiness and its causes. May you be truly well and happy. And then with each out-breath, imagine breathing out immeasurable rays of light from your heart, completely saturating their body and mind, and transforming into everything they need to be happy. So with each out-breath, breathe out the light of loving kindness, sending them whatever they need to be happy. And now imagine that they've found the genuine happiness that they seek, and take delight in this. And then release all appearances and simply allow the mind to come to rest. Simply resting in awareness itself. Without doing anything at all, just rest within luminously clear awareness. Relaxed and alert. Open and spacious. And while maintaining that open, spacious state, we can slowly end this meditation and begin our discussions together today. So again, let's begin with a short review of what we've covered so far. And maybe for this time it might be useful to have a look at the actual root text. So maybe if you want to have the root text in front of you, we'll have a look at some of the slogans that we've covered already. So of course we're using the 7-point mind training, the Lojong system of practice that was introduced into Tibet around the 11th century. And here in the 7-point mind training, the first of the 7 points is the presentation of the preliminaries, the basis. And the slogan there is, first train in the preliminaries. So we saw here that to have an effective basis for the main practice, the practice of wisdom and compassion, we need to establish a firm foundation through these preliminary practices, such as reflecting on precious human life and death and karma and the unsatisfactory nature of our existence. And by reflecting on these preliminaries and then also continuing to reflect on them during our main, as a preparatory practice to our main practice, we will have a solid foundation for our practice. We will have enthusiasm to do the practice, and our mind will be directed in a good direction for the practice as well, that we won't be lazy, we won't get caught up in chasing after a lot of sense pleasures and indulging in meaningless activities. And so then here we can see the 2nd point, training in the 2 minds of awakening, the main practice. So here the word mind of awakening, of course, is the translation of bodhicitta. So training in the 2 bodhicittas, the main practice. Of course, the two bodhicittas are conventional and ultimate bodhicitta. And here, in the next heading, we can see training in the ultimate awakening mind. So here we're talking about the wisdom practice, the wisdom of emptiness. And then we can see there are two outlines, the actual meditation session and the subsequent period practices. So as with every practice, we need to have a meditative practice to internalize that. And then also we need to have practices in the subsequent period in daily life to integrate this into our daily life. So we need both of these aspects. And here we see for the actual meditation session, there are four slogans here to help us to do this emptiness practice. The first was train to view all phenomena as dreamlike. So here we're talking about all of the phenomena, all the things that we perceive. To train to view them as dreamlike, meaning here that to see them as not existing in the way they appear. Because things appear to exist independent of us, but if we investigate these appearances, we'll come to realize that they're not existing in the way they appear, hence they're dreamlike. Because even though things appear to exist independent of us, if we investigate that, we'll come to see that there is no separate reality, a reality separate from the mind, that these worlds are mere appearances, meaning we bring these various objects into existence through drawing lines and giving names, that things exist within our conceptual framework. There is no object to be found amongst the bases out there. Hence, things are dreamlike. They are merely labeled by the mind. They are dependent phenomena. They not only depend on causes and conditions and parts, but they depend on labeling, imputation, a conceptual framework for them to exist. And by understanding this, we may come to the assumption then, or conclusion that, oh, because everything is really a product of our mind, then our mind is something substantial and real. To overcome this, we have the second statement. Examine the nature of the unborn awareness. Meaning if we turn our attention then to the mind itself, we will also come to see that the mind is not some separate, discrete thing existing independently. That the mind too is a dependent phenomena. It's also not inherently independently existent. Hence, unborn. Unborn means here not inherently produced, meaning not inherently existent. Thereby, we can understand that from these two, that all phenomena are lacking inherent existence or independent existence, which also is implied in the third statement. The remedy too is freed in its own place. The remedy, of course, is the wisdom of emptiness. Freed in its own place also meaning that it is lacking inherent existence as well. And then what we are to do is to place your mind on the basis of all the actual path. The basis of all here is emptiness. So to place your mind on the basis of all means once we've done this investigation and we've come to see that things are empty of independent existence, we're not finding this phenomena, then we are to place our mind in this state, means to hold that experience of not finding, which is an experience of emptiness. And if we do that, then that experience of emptiness will penetrate deeper into our mind. And if our ability to hold that experience is very good, meaning that we have a very stable and clear mind, we have the mind of shamatha, then that experience of emptiness can become a realization, not merely some little vague taste of emptiness. So by having a realization of emptiness, then that will be a stable experience, and by through that we can progress on the path, the actual path. And initially that will be a conceptual realization of emptiness, and then slowly that will deepen into a non-direct realization of emptiness, and thereby we can slowly move along the path, as we saw yesterday, thereby eliminating ignorance and the mental afflictions, eliminating all afflictive obscurations and achieving nirvana, and then going on to eliminate these subtle stains in our mind, the cognitive obscurations, going on to achieve enlightenment. So this is the actual meditation practice of ultimate bodhicitta or emptiness. Then what to do in daily life, the subsequent period practices, the next slogan, in the intervals, be a conjurer of illusions, meaning that we are to see things as like an illusion in daily life, meaning not to just merely accept appearances, but to investigate appearances. And from our emptiness practice, then we can really go on to see that things are really not existing as they're appearing, meaning they're illusory-like. And by doing this with respect to the things we see and with respect to ourselves as a person, then to see them as illusory-like in daily life means that we are lessening our grasping onto objects and ourself, which means we are lessening our chance of reacting to pleasant and unpleasant experiences with attachment and aversion. And of course that illusory-like experience will also feed back into our meditative practice. So this is the practice of ultimate bodhicitta, of emptiness. Then we see the next section is training in the conventional awakening mind. And here the meditative session has two slogans to help us. And so remember, here in the conventional bodhicitta, the approach we are using is exchanging self with others. So therefore, the meditative practice is this practice of tonglen, the training in the two, giving and taking alternately. So there we saw how to do that practice. And the next slogan says, place the two astride the breath, meaning that we can conjoin this imagining taking on others' suffering and giving away our happiness together with the breath, and that can help us to remain more focused in this practice. So by doing this meditative practice of tonglen, we are reducing the self-cherishing mind, we are increasing the mind of cherishing others, we are reducing attachment and aversion, we are increasing our loving kindness and compassion towards ourselves and others. And as we saw here in this practice, it is very helpful to practice this in stages, meaning first start with someone close to us. Once we're comfortable doing this tonglen with these friends, we can slowly extend it out to strangers, slowly out to people we find a little bit difficult, and then eventually all sentient beings. But also, if we are suffering from low self-esteem, if we don't really like ourselves, if we're not kind and compassionate to ourselves, then perhaps we need to begin this process by doing this tonglen with ourselves first. Because if we're not kind and compassionate to ourselves, then we're not going to be able to extend that out to others. So we can do this meditative practice in this way. And then how to continue to cultivate this in daily life? There are two slogans. There are three objects, three poisons, and three roots of virtue. So there we saw that the three objects, of course, are the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral objects. And generally when we experience these types of objects, we react with the three poisons of ignorance, attachment, and aversion. And so what we are to do in daily life is to not allow that to happen, meaning if we notice that we are starting to react, particularly with attachment and aversion, then instead of getting caught up in our attachment and aversion, we can use a tonglen style of approach, meaning that if we notice some aversion or anger arising in our mind, for example, then understand there must be countless other people in the world at the very moment who are caught up in anger and hatred and similar poison. Thereby, we can take on all the anger and hatred that others have at the moment in the world and take it on in terms of the Tonglen practice and then give them the root of virtue opposite to that, which would be compassion and loving kindness and wisdom. So send that out to them. So therefore we can transform our mental afflictions through the Tonglen practice into loving kindness and compassion and send this out to others as well. To support that, there's a next slogan, in all actions, train by means of the words, meaning to help remind us of exchanging self with others in daily life, we can pick a couple of short slogans to keep reminding us of this approach, to remind us to exchange self-cherishing with the mind of cherishing others. So we can pick some small short slogans, and a couple were mentioned in the commentary, and use that to remind us of these, to do this in daily life. So these are very good thing to do, is to have these reminders to help us, to remind us to do this. Otherwise, we're probably just going to continue to get caught up in our mental afflictions and old habits. So this is what to do in daily life. So these were the slogans then for the main practice, how to practice wisdom and compassion both in meditation and daily life. And now we're currently in the third of the 7 points, which is taking adverse conditions onto the path of enlightenment. And so this is one of the great strengths of the Lojong system of practice, because normally when we're faced with adverse conditions, difficult situations in our life, we see them as problems or obstacles, and thereby we are blocked, and we often then induce a lot of unnecessary suffering as well. But here, some advice we are given is that to see these difficult situations, adverse conditions, as actually as opportunities, as conditions conducive for spiritual growth. So the first statement here, a general statement, the slogan is saying, when the world and its inhabitants boil with negativity, transform adverse conditions into the path to enlightenment. How to do that? We see this is sort of divided into two parts. The first one is training in the two bodhicittas, the extraordinary thoughts, and then down the bottom, 3b, striving in the dual practice of accumulation and purification, the extraordinary activities. So again, we see here the first part of the answer, or the first part, is how to use our wisdom and compassion practices when we are faced with difficult situations in our life. To use those difficult situations to, in fact, practice the two aspects of wisdom and compassion, to strengthen those two aspects of our practice. And then to support that, how to use difficult situations in terms of this two practices of accumulation of merit and purification of negativities. So that's going to come later. So currently we are looking at the first part, which is how to use these adverse conditions to help us to train in the two bodhicittas. The first, of course, here is we are looking at the conventional awakening mind, meaning how to see these difficult situations to help us to continue to work on our conventional bodhicitta. And here the essential practice is to see in these difficult situations who or what is our real enemy and who or what is our real friend. Because in general, when we are faced with a difficult situation in life, we tend to, of course, blame other things and other people as a source of our suffering. So we tend to see other things and other people as the enemy. And then we often see the self-cherishing mind as our friend. It seems like this self-cherishing mind is our friend bringing us happiness. But here, these two slogans that we're looking at now are basically telling us, in fact, if we look closely, it's exactly the opposite. That it's our self-cherishing mind that is our worst enemy, and that it actually is others who are our friends. Even others who seem to creating harm toward us. Even those people we can see as our friends. So we are currently looking at the first of those, which is to banish all blames to the single source. Meaning to really see that the self-cherishing mind is the source of is our enemy, is the source of our suffering. And so with that, we are in that section, and we are now on page 102 in the middle. We're nearly finished that section, and then we're going to look on to seeing that sentient being, others are our friends and that we should cherish them, even those who seem to be trying to create us harm. So we are in the middle of page 102. I think we left off where the last thing was, by engaging in the middle in these practices, the master entreated, so master again is Geshe Chikawa, strive to the best of your ability to subdue this self-grasping demon during your brief life. So that's where we finish, so let's continue on. And then Shawopa is another one of the early great Tibetan Lojong masters. I think he was a disciple of Langri Tampa, who of course was the author of the other main Lojong text, the 8 verses of mind training that is widely taught as well still today. And shortly we're going to come into a little connection with that 8 verses of mind training text. It appears very shortly in the commentary. So he says, so long as we fail to see our own self as the enemy, no one, including our teachers, can save us. If we see it as the enemy, benefits will ensue. So remember, every place here where they say my own self, we are to understand, of course, that means our own self-grasping, self-cherishing mind. That is the enemy. Otherwise, if we look at this, we may start seeing me, the person, is the enemy. But that's not what we're saying. We're not, that me, the person, is not the enemy, but it is our self-grasping, self-cherishing mind which is the enemy. So then it goes on, it says, so if you view your own self as the enemy, even when harms caused by hosts of non-humans and malevolent elemental spirits befall you, these become harms perpetuated against the enemy. They become aids in your battle against self-grasping. Since they are a powerful army on your side, it is inappropriate to generate anger towards these agents of harm. Rather, you should look on them with joy. So, of course, when we see that, that sort of looks a bit strange. And we may misinterpret that, and we may look at that and we think, okay, that does that mean that if someone is trying to harm us, that we shouldn't respond, we should just smile and let them do what they want to us? Is that what it means by should look on them with joy? We should just smile and be happy that they're harming us? No, that's not what it's saying. What it's saying, of course, is to not react with anger if someone is trying to harm us. Because reacting with anger often causes the situation to get completely out of control. And, of course, every time we react with anger, that strengthens our anger. And we really don't want to be doing that. So what it's saying here, rather, is when it says you should look on them with joy, what it's saying is, of course, one is not to react with anger. Two is to look on them with joy means that person who is trying to harm us is actually providing us an opportunity. Therefore, we should have joy. Because, you know, we need to develop qualities such as patience and forbearance and compassion in the spiritual path. But if people are not testing us, if they're not challenging us, if they're not trying to say something negative towards us, then it's actually quite difficult to fully develop compassion, to develop our patience and forbearance. Because if everyone is very nice to us, we may just live under the illusion that I never have any anger, I've got rid of anger, and I'm a very patient person. Because no one is testing us. Whereas if people test us, then we can check to see whether we are really a patient person or we get angry and irritated. So these people are providing us the opportunity to develop these qualities. Therefore, we should have joy. And of course, also they're helping us to increase our compassion as well. So therefore, with that joyful state of mind, understanding that there is now an opportunity. Of course, that doesn't mean that the situation is not difficult. Yes, it will be difficult. But if we see it as an opportunity rather than as an obstacle or a problem, then we can benefit from it and we can help others as well. Then we can use this situation to develop our compassion and our patience, our perseverance, our forbearance. Meaning that if someone is trying to harm us, rather than react out of anger and the situation getting out of control, remain patient and calm and then evaluate the situation better and then respond with compassion. And if it's a very difficult situation where the person is really engaging in some very harmful action, then if it's a verbal action, then we may need to use very strong language to get across to them that this action is very harmful. So we can use very strong language with a compassionate motivation, or if that person is engaging in some physical harm, we may even need to use some physical force to restrain that person. So we can use that with compassion. But again, if we allow anger to enter into our mind, then often that physical force, we often sometimes use excessive physical force, and then the thing gets out of control. So this is what it's really saying here. So then, if we just go on, it says, at some point in the future, the master said, there will emerge a true spiritual practice that can free you from the narrow gorges of adverse conditions. Meaning that if we do this, at some point in the future, we're going to see all conditions, whether they're favorable or they're difficult situations, as conditions conducive to spiritual practice. At that point, you should train in recognition of others as friends. In this manner, train now to distinguish between self and others as enemy and friends, respectively. And then there's a little bit more, another little bit of thing we can do to maybe help us in that. So there's another little thing that's mentioned in the next paragraph, which we'll now go, and then maybe there's some questions on this section. It says, occasionally, you should train your mind also by drawing a distinction between enemy and friend, even within yourself. Meaning that to distinguish between enemy and friend within yourself, meaning the enemy in ourself, of course, is our self-grasping, self-cherishing, our mental afflictions, and the friend within ourself, of course, is the positive states of mind, wisdom, loving kindness, and compassion. It says here, you can give your lay name to your thoughts and actions concerned with the pursuit of your own welfare, and your ordination name to your thoughts and actions concerned with the pursuit of others' welfare. So, of course, often we find in the spiritual tradition that if someone is going to become a monk or a nun, they're given a new name. So this is this ordination name. But also sometimes in the Tibetan tradition, you will find that when people do the refuge ceremony, meaning now we have made a commitment to follow Buddha Dharma Sangha, then sometimes also there people get an ordination name, a new name. And so then it's saying that we can use these to relate to the negative states of mind and the positive states of mind, and respectively see the self-grasping, self-cherishing mental afflictions as our enemy, and as our friend is then the positive states of mind, cherishing others, wisdom, compassion, loving kindness. And then it goes on to say, then following the example of the spiritual mentor Ben, correlate your arms left and right to avoidance of non-virtue and adoption of virtuous acts. So I think there was a early Tibetan master called Ben who had this idea of the left hand was the relating to non-virtues and the right hand he related to virtuous actions. And then he said, I have no other task than to stand guard with a short spear of the antidote at the entrance of my mind. When they, the afflictions, are vigilant, I too am vigilant. When they are relaxed, I too am relaxed. Also, you should be vigilant, and again, here's the Tibetan expression we had earlier, strike at the snout of each boar with a cane and chase it, meaning to have vigilance or mindfulness in daily life, so that if we notice a mental affliction arising, we strike it on the snout, meaning don't allow it to bring its entire body into the room and dominate our mind, but rather to not allow it to grow, to strike it on the snout, not to get caught up in it with identifying with it and not trying to suppress it. So here again, mindfulness is going to be very helpful for us for that, to notice when these mental afflictions are arising and not to allow them into our mind by identifying with them or trying to suppress them. All the sutras and the commentarial treatises too demonstrate that there is no task other than eliminating self-grasping. And of course here we're talking also about self-cherishing coming from that self-grasping. These then present the view of one's own self. Again, self-grasping, self-cherishing is the enemy, and the elimination of self-grasping. Because of Shōwopa's teachings, the expression, the practice for smashing the demon's head evolved. So again, the demon's head, of course, is the self-grasping, self-cherishing mind. So that is the first part of the how to see these difficult situations, to use them as tools to increase our conventional bodhicitta, our mind of cherishing others. The first part of that is to, of course, to see that actually don't blame others or other things for difficult situations, but understand that the real enemy is not others, but the real enemy is our own self-grasping, self-cherishing mind. So that's the first part of the answer, and we're going to go now to the second part of the answer, which is to the second part of that is to see others as our friends and cherish them, even others who seem to be trying to harm us, and to how we can see them as our friends. So before I go on to that, is there anything from the section we've just covered before I move on to the next?
I was wondering about this technique of feeling your one name to your one grasp at all at my actions, no matter if they're good or bad, because I shouldn't identify with my actions. But as soon as I give the name, I'm really used to my name, right? And now I give this name to all my bad thoughts, bad actions. Says, oh, this is just Max acting, but Kelsa, he's a good one.
Yeah. So again, well, of course, if we don't have this sort of ordination name, then this, of course, doesn't apply to us. But remember, in those times, then I think most people adopted a new name when they did the refuge or became monk or nun. So maybe this is something more relevant in 12th century Tibet than in the modern day. But what it's not saying is what we should not do is do cognitive fusion. That's what we do now, you know. I am an angry person. I am a bad person. I'm a nasty person. I'm a lazy person. I'm a useless person. This is not what it's suggesting. This is cognitive fusion. So we should not do that regardless of whether we're trying to use this technique or not. I mean, that's often what we do now. We identify ourselves with the contents of our mind. So what it's saying here is to use some sort of technique to distinguish between the positive aspects of our mind and the negative aspects of our mind. And so we can also use this other technique from this Ben, who's saying he's sort of identifying the non-virtuous things with the left hand and the virtuous with the right. So it's just a way of distinguishing the aspects of our mind that we need to not get caught up in to eliminate, and the aspects of the mind that we need to cultivate. But if we, of course, identify ourselves with either of those two, then we're going to have problems, regardless of whether we're using these techniques or not. So that's one thing we don't want to do. Yeah, we don't want to say, oh, Glenn is identified with all the negative stuff. Oh, Glenn, bad, bad, bad Glenn, bad Glenn, bad Glenn. No. This is what we tend to do now. So this is not what it's suggesting. It's just trying to use some techniques that were maybe some little tools that some people used at that time to distinguish the two aspects of our mind, the ones that we need to reduce and eliminate, and what we need to increase. That's all. So whatever technique for that, that's what we can do. That's all. Otherwise, we end up in the wrong place. Sure. Right. So, yes. So, I think I briefly mentioned this earlier, but this is also quite an important point, is here, of course, we're talking about eliminating self-cherishing and just cherishing others. And then sort of people sort of understand that, you know, maybe the self-cherishing, I need to really get rid of it. But then what often people do is, when they're about to do something, they notice that they have a little bit of a selfish motivation, and they go, oh, no, that's not right. I'm not going to do that because I have at least partially a selfish motivation. So I'm not going to do it because there's some selfishness there. So they don't do the good thing. I think this would be a big mistake, because if we don't do something because there's some selfishness in there, I think we're never going to start to do anything for others, because the reality is that we have quite a strong selfish motivation. And, you know, it may even just be a little bit, you know, I'm doing this, and we have the expectation at least they're going to say thank you to me. And if they don't, I'm going to get upset. So even that is a little bit the selfish motivation. So it's very hard for us now to do something for others with zero self-cherishing. I'd say it would be just about almost impossible for most average people. Therefore, what we should do is, when we come into a situation, when we're actually trying to help others, or even in the Tonglen giving, if we notice some little bit of selfishness creeping in, then notice that and try to let go of that as much as possible and still do that action. So if you're in the Tonglen, you're noticing that when you're doing this giving, you have this thing, oh, I'm really a generous person. I'm really giving a lot, aren't I? Then just sort of let go of that as much as possible and focus more on the person as much as possible. And then you'll find that the more you do that, of course, the self-cherishing mind will reduce, and the more the mind of cherishing others will increase. So it's sort of like a gradual process to do this. So don't stop yourself in the meditation or stop yourself in daily life from helping others simply because you notice a little bit of a selfishness in there. Notice it and try to let go of it as much as possible and still do it. And then slowly we'll find that it less selfishness, more cherishing others.
Um,
You can do, yeah, I mean, you can either do straight in or you can do, I mean, because you're breathing in, it may feel more natural to breathe it in actually through the nostrils and bring it down. Or if you find it's more better to just direct, that's also okay. Doesn't matter. Well, again, in general, for example, the analogy, if we have a dark room, if we switch on the light, the darkness is immediately dispelled, isn't it? So same thing here, we have this light, the darkness is immediately dispelled when it's confronted by light. It's gone. So, we can imagine just dissolving it in the light. I mean, and again, we can use whatever sort of visualization there that we find most helpful. Of course, we can do that as well. Yes. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So that was what the daily life practice was. Yeah, I mean, that was the daily life practice. If we have a mental affliction, if we have selfish mind come up, take on the selfish mind of everyone else and then give them the mind of cherishing others, yes. Yeah, again, the thing was here, to remind ourselves using words. So if that little slogan is helpful, then we can use that to remind ourselves in daily life. Yes, sure. Yeah. Sure, sure, sure.
In Tonglen, there was a part in the text that says the best thing we can give them is spiritual development or a spiritual teacher or something like that.
Of course,
just for a very, very long time after I was introduced to Buddhism, I, maybe consciously or unconsciously, tried to convert other people to Buddhism. And when I saw this part of the text, how not to fall again to that place of Buddhism is the best for you, you have to do that.
So again, that's the self-cherishing mind. I know what's best for you. You need to do this. So again, when we're doing this, we should be looking at them. What would they appreciate most now in a positive way? And it may be simply they need some shelter. They maybe just need some food. They maybe just need some comforting. So send them whatever. Try to understand what they would need in the short term and what they would be looking for in the long term. And then you can be you can send them, may you encounter the best possible conditions for you to become, have a more meaningful life. You need to find a Buddhist teacher. No. You can make it more gentle, because if they're not Buddhist, then that's not appropriate. You can simply say, may you find all the conditions you require to make your life more meaningful, to reduce your suffering, to strive for genuine happiness. So you can leave it like that. And if that happens to be, then they meet some Christian teacher or Muslim teacher or Hindu teacher or atheist teacher, that's fine. That's fine.
Could you please make the distinction between patience and forbearance?
Usually they are the same, different English words for the same original term. So sometimes you see patience, sometimes you see forbearance. But also within patience, when we looked at in the six perfections, there are a number of different types of patience. And in one of those, it's this sort of being patient with difficult situations. And so sometimes that is called forbearance, to forbear with difficult situations. So sometimes then forbearance is used as one of the types of patience, but often you'll find that they're just different translators are using patience or forbearance for the same original word as well.
Going to break down reality to the ground and on the other hand to put it, with a lot symbolism and imagination, and we're having a lot of metaphors.
So that's actually exactly the two sides of a coin. Emptiness means dependent arising. Exactly. Because things are empty, therefore things are not fixed. Therefore, we have what you said, all these concepts to help us to better understand all these appearances. So they're actually complementary. They're two sides of a coin. Right.
A lot of symbols which create a lot of imagination and association and even the language.
But this is exactly the point. Because there is no fixed objective reality, therefore everything exists within the conceptual framework. Therefore there is a lot of symbolism and all of this. That is the reason. If there were a fixed objective reality, then your point would be valid. They would be contradictory because there is a fixed objective reality and we're fabricating something that's different to that. So then your point would be valid. But this view is saying there is no fixed objective reality. Therefore, everything exists within the conceptual framework. But there is no objective basis, fixed objective basis. That's the point. If there was, then a lot of this symbolism, we could say, well, that's against reality, because there's reality and all this stuff we've created is artificial and it's not real, because the real thing is the stuff. So then you could have an argument to say, this symbolism is false, is fake. We need to get rid of that. And instead, we need to focus on the reality itself. But there is no fixed objective reality to focus on.
No, I don't want to say it's false or something, but I just wonder that it is used.
We have to use it, otherwise we couldn't make any meaning. If we have no conceptions and symbolism and so forth, then how could we function? We couldn't. We couldn't function. The trick, of course, is to make useful concepts, meaningful concepts. Otherwise, of course, we go astray. So that's the trick, is to make some sense or meaning in a meaningful way out of all of this stuff. That's the thing, the challenge. Okay, anything else? Yes. Yeah.
What would that look like? You know, like in my daily life, while I'm interacting with the students, and I feel frustration coming up.
Yeah. Yeah.
What does that actually look like?
I'll give brief answer because more of that is coming in this section about adverse conditions. It's coming up very shortly, actually. Like a number of things we can do, and actually a lot of it comes here, but I'll give a brief answer. Like if someone's starting to irritate you, then we can apply both the wisdom and we can do a lot of things. One is simply mindfulness, is observe the irritation arise, don't get caught up in it, and allow it to pass. So that could be... Because you'll find that if you develop mindfulness, you're talking and then you're noticing this irritation come up, and then you go, oh, that's interesting, and then not buying into it. But now, of course, we're not mindful and we're talking and the irritation's coming up, we don't even realize... until we've got completely, we've opened our mouth and exploded. Then we sort of, oh, okay. Then it's too late. So one is mindfulness. Then, of course, on top of that, we can apply both the wisdom and compassion, as we're looking at now in this particular section, is that the compassion side is if we are getting irritated, then we can take on their or everyone's irritation and send them happiness. So we can do this even while we're talking, just imagining this. Also, of course, we can apply the wisdom side, is if we notice irritation coming up, is there something in that person that, what is it that's making me irritated? You know, look for that. Or where is the me here that's becoming irritated? So again, if we've trained in these, we can do these very quickly and then lessen the irritation. And then on top of that, we can do these Tonglen style practices to not to use this irritative place to increase our wisdom and compassion. But a lot of what you've asked is still to come now in this section here. Okay, so then let's move on to the next section. So it says, recognizing sentient beings as friend and cherishing them. Second, the viewing of sentient beings as friends and cherishing them is presented in the following line. Towards all beings, contemplate their great kindness. So now comes two sections in terms of how to cultivate loving kindness and compassion. And in particular here, they are focusing on people who are trying to harm us. But first there's a little statement, a quote from Shapupa, who's again one of these great Tibetan masters in the Lojong tradition, who says, calls this the spiritual practice of carrying the flesh and carrying the blood. I'm not exactly sure how to interpret that statement. Again, it's probably a very Tibetan sort of saying. The second one I think is a little bit easier to understand. It is called the practice of accepting all ill omens as charms. So that one is a little bit easier to appreciate, is that now we tend to see difficult situations as problems. Rather, here what we're saying is to see difficult situations as opportunities. So rather than seeing things as ill omens as charms would be to see accepting all problems as opportunities. And then it says here, one deliberately focuses on the perpetrators of harm and cultivates loving kindness and compassion and trains in giving and taking. So it's actually sort of a little bit interesting here that in the text we're talking about the perpetrators of harm rather than the harmers. Because if we say harmer, that's cognitive fusion. You know, bad person, harmer. Where perpetrator of harm is a person who is doing a harmful action. So this is a better way of thinking. Perpetrator of harm. There's a person who's doing a harmful action. Because if we just say, oh, there's a harmer, then we're going to have the difficulties we saw in the cognitive fusion earlier. There's a harmer, there's a bad person, and then, of course, we tend to attack the harmer. We get upset or angry at the harmer. And now we have two sections about how to develop loving kindness and compassion towards these people who are trying to harm us. But before we launch into these two explanations, it's time for morning tea break. So let's have a morning tea break and come back at 10:45.